What's up, guys? You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We record episodes and interview the very best experts from around the world and cover topics relating to health, success, mindset, business, and even social issues. And each week, we give you some of the best advice and information on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. Your elite life begins now.
On today's episode, episode number 352, entitled How to Survive in the Wilderness, I chat with Dan Wowak. Dan Wowak is an outdoor skills instructor, survivalist, former guest star of the History Channel's Alone Show, and owner of Coal Cracker Bushcraft, an Appalachian Bushman school. In today's episode, Dan talks about how to survive in the wilderness and what to do to ensure you make it back to civilization. He breaks down the process for building shelter and fire and gathering and maintaining water and food in your journey back home. If you're wondering how to master the elements of nature and survive in the wilderness, check this episode out now. You are going to love it.
If you haven't joined the Elite Man newsletter, make sure you join right now at EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter, where you get all the latest updates, information, news, and all the information that you won't find anywhere else, whether that's social media, even on the podcast, our latest deals. Everything gets put on the newsletter first, and it is the best place to get all the information you need. Also, we will be making a big announcement in the next few days about that project I mentioned about a month ago of what we've been working on sort of behind the scenes the last couple of months. We'll be making an announcement on the newsletter within the next few days. So you're going to want to jump on the newsletter now if you haven't gotten on it, or if you haven't been on it for a while, you're going to want to check your email in the next few days for a big announcement. So EliteManMagazine.com/newsletter. Make sure you join today. And as always, guys, if you haven't got the single greatest self-help book ever written, go to elitemindbook.com and get yourself a copy of Elite Mind, a real-world guide to overcoming anxiety, conquering depression, and unleashing your inner confidence. If you have a problem with any of these areas, you're going to want to get the single greatest self-help book ever written, elitemindbook.com. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine. And my guest today is Dan Wowak, from Coal Cracker Bushcraft. I came across him on the YouTube channel, and I know he has a ton of other things he's doing. But are you the founder, Dan? I want to know that myself. I'm not sure.
Yes, okay. I started the company.
The whole thing. It blew up. I don't know how many followers you have on YouTube now, but it's in the 100,000, right? Hundreds of thousands.
Oh, yeah. We're 307, right around 360, 370 somewhere. So we recently got a good kick there to get a good bump. So yeah, we're doing good.
That's awesome, man. And how many years ago did you start it?
This is my sixth year doing YouTube.
Oh, shit.
Wow. Yep. I used to just do it here and there once in a while. And then once we get in how, I guess, the whole business came about, I got more serious with it because I had a lot of extra time on my hands. And that's when it really took off when I put a ton of time into it. So,
yeah. And I'm sure the first like couple of years was like, you know, just dragging your feet type of thing and a couple subscribers. Yeah. I mean, I have a YouTube channel. It's small because I haven't really put much focus on it. The big platform is the podcast, but man, I'm pumped even in the first couple of videos when I'm getting like, you know, 10 subscribers a day or 30 subscribers a day. It's like, you know, you get a big boost and then now you're like at the 300K plus mark. And it's like, you know, it's become a its own beast now. And, you know, you get 1,000 a day or something like that, I'm sure now.
Oh, yeah.
And, it's so much more cool. You're just reaching so many more people. And like me, you know, I'm Googling stuff one night and I forget exactly what it was. And I come across your video and it was something, you know what it was? I went hunting a couple months ago with a buddy. Okay. So I'm looking up some, you know, little survivalist stuff here and there because we're in the middle of Vermont woods. It's like I'm not a super outdoorsy guy, although I'm trying to become more of that. And, you know, I want to know a couple of things on like what I can do to survive. And just if something happens, something goes down, what I got to bring. I got a little pack right here, which we're going to talk about in a little bit of like what I actually brought to the hunting trip. But it's like there's a lot of skills out there that guys have absolutely no idea about, you know, how to do it, how to survive. Like if something happens in the woods, you have to live outside for a while. And I think these are a lot of essential things. I'm trying to learn more and more of this myself. I'm trying to teach my guys this stuff. But I feel like, you know, guys like you are experts at this. We could learn so much from you. So first of all, before we dive into some specifics, and I got a ton of questions, how did you become this expert? Like, what is your background? Did you grow up outside? Did you, were you an outdoorsy type of kid? How did you become this, you know, guy that you are today?
Yeah. So I always tell people I have a medium length story and a long story with it. I'll give you the medium length. I don't even think I ever told anybody a couple of these things because this is legitimately how this all started. So I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains of Pennsylvania. So if you like, my town's real small. It's 1 mile long. If you go right, left, north, south, east, west, no matter where you go, you just go into the Appalachian Mountains. So we spent a lot of time in the woods with my friends doing stuff. A lot of fishing, some hunting, learning to trap, pretending we knew about survival. We had no idea when I look back at it, but we had a good time going out all the time. So almost my whole life, up till high school, that was my life. Weekends, after school, go out in the woods and do stuff. And then when I went away to college, I sort of got away from that for a bit. I was more worried about girls and going out and partying and doing all that stuff. And then got done college, still chasing the women around, still partying a lot. And then I met my now wife. So we started dating and I dialed back the partying a little bit and I got into shooting. So I was like in a tactical shooting. I'd go to these competitions, like, you know, shoot against the guy next to you kind of thing. And I was really, really getting into this. So I never had any military background or anything, but I just loved that outdoor survival part of stuff. So the shooting led into like, hey, can I bug out? What's a bug out bag? We put a bug out bag together, a get home bag, all this kind of stuff that most guys, I think, nowadays like to put together. And it's fun to play with gear. So I did that. And I was at a shooting competition. It was like a long range sniper type competition. And we had to do one of them sniper stocks like you see on TV where the guys actually go out and they put the ghillie suits on. So I had to make a ghillie suit and do all this, totally bombed out on it. And I was walking back to the bus that they took us out to the field in. And the instructor, the guy that was like managing the field, he was like, he's talking to me. I said, which way do we go? We came to this fork in the road. And he's like, you're at a sniper competition and you can't see the footprints to the left. And I was like it just hit a chord with me. And I was like, oh my, like I grew up in the woods. How do I not like, I didn't like, I don't know this. Right. So, that was it. I got done there and I started going out more on my own. I took my bug out bag. I'd mess around. I'd set up like a half-ass shelter. And then, I went out with my one friend one night and we tried to do like a mock bug out. Horrible situation. Too cold. Our feet were freezing. We didn't have enough food. Couldn't get the shelter set up. So I just have the kind of personality that drives me insane. So I like immersed myself in this world of survival. I got my old survival books out and started messing with everything. And I just fell in love with it. And I realized, hey, I'm catching on all this stuff. And I love the experimenting of it. So if I couldn't figure it out, I would keep working at it till I did. And then I wanted to not only just say, hey, I can get a flint and steel fire, but why does this work? And how else can I do it with everything with it? So I did that and continued that process, just going through and learning these little disciplines one at a time, sharing them with my friends. And then I started working at a school out in Ohio, a survival school after I took a couple courses there. And I'm like, man, I'm not bad at teaching. Like I really, you know, I can really communicate well with people how to do these things. So once I started teaching, that takes you really to the next level because you not only have to be able to do the skill, but now I got to be able to explain to people how this skill works, why it works, how you have to apply it, and then be able to look at, well, what are they messing up? How do their wrist is weird or the rock on a flint and steel is different or the ferro rod's not at the right angle. So that really took me like to the next level. And then once I got done working there, now through this time I worked in the juvenile justice field. So I was working with like juvenile delinquents and stuff. It was good at first. Then I was burned out. I hated it. So luckily the facility downsized and closed that I was on. So I got laid off. So I'm like, well, I could probably keep teaching, but this ain't like a gig that you make a lot of money at. So I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm like, I'll collect unemployment. So I go 2 weeks unemployment. I get a call. It was the casting company for Alone, the television show.
Oh, yeah.
So they talked to me. I'm like, yeah, I would definitely do this. I go through the process. I got on season 3. So I was out there for 51 days and Patagonia. And while I didn't win. So I ended up tapping out there. I was starving to death. I wanted to see my family, you know, and I got back. I was in the airport and I was like, man, there's more to life than punching a 9-to-5 you know, job every day. I don't want to do that again. I was burned out with it. I'm doing something I love, and I love this outdoor stuff. I'm good at teaching. I'm starting my own company. And that's when I started Cold Cracker. And then it was like my back's against the wall. Now I have no money and I have to make this work, you know? So, and yeah. that started, and then here we are now today. So, that was sort of my journey with it. And, the whole learning part, you know, from just being exposed to the woods when I was young, was a huge help because I was comfortable out there. It was just to learn those skills and then diving in them skills deeper. And then ultimately teaching really, I can even tell my instructors, I have 5 instructors now that work at my school with me. I could tell when they first came on till now, even after some of them have only been there a year with me, their skill level is drastically increased because just working with individuals over and over and over and drilling them skills really makes, I mean, that's really what starts to take you to that next level.
Yeah. Wow. What an amazing story, man. That, you know, that's so cool. And, so I didn't even know you were on that show, by the way. I've seen the show on TV, you know, a bunch of times over the years, but how many, so you said 51 days, how many days did the winter last?
I think, did he go 81? Wow. Somewhere in there.
That's insane. I'm going to check out your episode on there, man, and see how you were doing.
I was starving. I only ate 9 fish in 51 days that I was there. So I'm like a bigger guy. I'm 6'2", like 230. I normally walk around.
Yeah.
I lost 54 pounds in 51 days.
Holy shit.
I was there. So I was like, I was in a hurt locker towards the end there.
Yeah.
So probably would have got medically pulled if I stayed a lot longer, but I did. I mean, I got to the point I was like, I just don't want to be here anymore. I feel horrible. I miss my family. And when you don't eat and you're starving to death like that, your whole mindset really changes a lot. Cause I look back now and some of the things, I mean, I can remember thinking some of the things at night there, just about like everyday kind of living stuff. And it's bizarro because you're in survival mode. You literally get something to eat the next day, or you have to struggle through the next day without food. So it's a wild sense of stuff.
Yeah. Do you think now that you've learned a lot more things, you improved your skill, you now teach a lot of people, do you think that you do a lot better now? I mean, that 51 days is impressive no matter how you look at it. Like, that's incredible, but
there's a part of me that wants to say like, yeah, like I have a manly part of me. I'm like, yeah, I definitely. But there's another part of me, my mindset has shifted so much since then. I'm so much more now focused on my business and teaching that I don't have that. Like that got, I used to run like the, you know, Tough Mudder races. And yeah. So they had World's Toughest Mudder. It was like 24-hour race.
Oh, you did
like,
that one?
Oh, I do them because I had it like I had this like I have
shit
myself that I'm like hardcore. So after that, I lost a little bit of that now, which I hate to admit because I always want to be like I'm on top of my game always. But I lost that little bit of like I have to prove this. And I so going back out, I don't know if I would how good I don't know what that would be like. That would be a test for me to have to go back through that. You know,
yeah, I honestly think too, you know, just studying psychology and human behavior over the years, I think that you really could do it if you had to do it. But the question is like, would you want to do it? Would you choose to do something like that? I don't think so at this point, because you're a different guy, you're, you know, getting older, mature, different things coming up. But I think if you were put in that situation, like if you actually really had to bug out for like a dire situation, I think you could do it.
Yes.
And no, be better.
I definitely agree. It's funny because yesterday I went through my head, I was running. I'm into fitness a lot. So I had a weight vest on, a sandbag, and I was doing my little like 5K run with it. And I was beat. I was tired. It was super cold here in Pennsylvania. I'm just like chugging along. And I was like, if this was 3 years ago, this would have been like a big issue for me, like to battle through. Now I'm like, just shut up and just move. And I'm just like going along with it. So yeah, I totally agree with that. It's the kind of thing you do it, you know, you can do it. And if you have to do it, it's there. It's like in the gas tank still.
Yeah.
Well, I want to do that. That's a great way to put that.
Yeah. And it's funny, man, because you actually fooled me, you know, someone who watched, again, I turned on your YouTube channel. I watched like 30 videos in a row. I just kept clicking. Next thing you know, I'm like, I got to go to bed. This is getting ridiculous. But you fooled me because you came across as someone who knew this stuff your whole life. So it's interesting to hear that actually you had a little bit of background being outside. And I kind of was actually an outdoorsy kid myself. Not probably to the extent of that you were, but you had a little bit of that, but you weren't really this, you know, expert outdoors enthusiast that you are today. And these are a lot of the skills that you learn, which means that all the guys that you're teaching in these videos and these instructors and stuff, anybody can learn this stuff. It's, you know, replicable over and over again if you want to actually, you know, listen to the videos and listen to the instruction that you're giving out.
Oh yeah, 100%. If you want to immerse yourself in that, you can. I mean, the sky's the limit with how good you want to get with all that stuff and how much time you want to put in too. I mean, I put a lot of time in the first few years that I really was hard into it. That I'm like, I'm learning this stuff. And it was literally for no reason other than I was passionate about it. One of the years, and I'm like, why is my wife still with me? Because she was dating me at the time. I'm like, I kept track. I'd stay 200 nights out in the woods. Now, this was like over time. So I'd stay out some nights and get up and run home and go get a shower and go to work just because I was like experimenting with stuff and doing stuff. So I'm still not sure how I held on to her, but I did. So, I mean, I put a lot of time into to doing all that, but definitely to your question, definitely manageable for anybody that wants to dive into that. And you don't have to put that much time in. You know, people take classes with us that are 3 days and they leave. And but I'm 100% sure they can have an emergency in the woods and they can manage themselves till somebody finds them.
Yeah. And you know, what's funny too, is one of the last videos I saw that you did was the one about trees, and not necessarily the trees falling, but the branches falling and almost like spearing you to death. And I remember sitting out in the woods, you know, a couple of weeks before I'd seen it. And I'm just like, I actually fell asleep. I found a tree and it was pretty comfortable. I found a little spot when I'm out there hunting and I was so tired. I took a nap for probably an hour. And then I see the video a couple of weeks later. I'm like, I could have very well have been like in a death trap for all I know. Cause I'm not out there looking for the types of clues that you're looking at and telling people to look for in the videos. But, it's very interesting. There's a lot of things that you don't think of. And then like when someone, you come across someone like you, or you watch a video, it makes so much sense. Like it's almost like intuitive. Is a lot of this process, like if we're keeping our mind open, our eyes open, and you know, we're going out into the woods, is a lot of this stuff just like paying attention to what's around you and kind of putting pieces together and you can kind of, you know, make good and be safe doing those types of things?
Yes. That is one of the biggest things. Now, I don't think that you can just say, okay, I'm turning that on. I'm going to be more aware. It's a skill of being out there and learning that awareness. And I can give an example of that. A lot of individuals will come out and they know they're at my school property. They know that if you go a certain direction so far, you hit a road and you hit a pole line and like you're sort of in this little box that you can't get lost. Yet we send them out on a navigation course. They're totally... they have no idea where they're at. Like they are just gone. They feel like they are in the backcountry of Montana. There is nobody for a million miles and they are spinning in circles with their compass, like, and panicking. So it's just that awareness. And we can walk up to them as instructors and get super close to the point that, and if you were in a mall or a convenience store, you'd like look next to you because somebody's standing there. We're standing there. They'll walk right by us, have no idea we're even there. So like they get this tunnel vision. So, you know, that's a little induced stress because we're making them do tasks. But to your point, that's definitely something that awareness is something that takes you to that next level. And for a normal person, just being aware and always thinking where you're walking, what's around you, what did you see? Those things, they help out tremendously because you think, hey, I'm lost. Well, okay, 2 minutes ago, I just walked downhill. If I head back up the hill, I'm going to be back somewhere closer to where I started. I crossed a stream. Here's a stream. Like those types of things. Even with you, like, hey, I'm hunting. You're looking where the wind's blowing. So, you know, you're not scaring off. What are you hunting, deer?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you're looking where the wind is. Then you're looking at, hey, there's no branches are going to fall on my head. Those types of things. You know, in the whole scheme of stuff, yes, that's really important stuff. It makes you that much better. A lot of people don't look at it that way though, because they want to do the cool stuff. They want to throw massive sparks with a ferro rod and set up a shelter and do all that kind of cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, so I tried to pick a good spot and it was basically trying to be a little higher up. I was right by his nice little stream, which was actually kind of like relaxing. And I think put me to sleep. I had a field to the left, to the right of me that was pretty open and I could see if there's any deer popping up on that side. I had a pretty good view from where I was, like on this little hill to seeing, you know, down below me. And then I did actually kind of look around. I did look up and make sure that there wasn't any, like giant branches hanging right over me. Now I didn't do the whole thing that you did, which I thought would have been a lot more important, like looking into the ground, seeing if there was like some of those tree limbs sticking into the ground, like spears. I didn't do any of that stuff. And I didn't really like look around the whole area. I just kind of like chose a spot that I thought would be like a comfortable place to relax, but there was a lot more detail that you went into, in that video. And maybe you can talk about something that I missed, but, you know, in how important it is too, because a lot of guys, what do they call it? The Widowmaker.
Yeah. Widowmakers. Yeah.
These branches actually literally come down and can
impale guys. So they always think, oh, I got to watch so the tree's not rotted. Don't go by a big tree. It's rotted. It's going to fall. But the vast majority of the time, you hear that tree long before it's going to fall. I mean, you could hear it cracking and starting to go. I've seen a few trees, not a lot, but a few trees fall out there. And I mean, you know, they're going and you have time to see where they're falling, get out of the way kind of thing. It's the branches. When them things go, especially if it's windy and it's loud and there's other stuff going on, when them things come down, they're literally like torpedoes just driving into the ground. And sometimes, I've seen them already 4 and 5 inches in diameter, like 3 and 4 feet stuck into the ground. I mean, that will easily take you out real quick, you know? So it's the branches is a big one that people they just look for dead trees. And all right, here we go. And it's more, hey, like in your case, you're not going to be there overnight. So we're just looking, are there branches that are going to fall? Is there anything right above me that can fall? If not, probably good to go. When you're staying there longer term, that's when you need to worry about trees. Because you're in your shelter and you're all snuggled up in a campfire asleep and you hear trees crackling all night. You might not think much of it. A storm rolls in, it's raining, it's thunder and it's lightning. And now a tree's fallen. Pitch black, you have no idea where to run, where it's coming from. So that's where you need to really do that full assessment. Look at the ground, look at the tree itself, look at the branches above. Are the roots, you know, starting to rot and to get exposed from water? All those things. And the other thing too is just if you're right where you're at and you like tie off your shelter to a tree and you're going to sleep, well, trees are big. So if a tree, you know, 20 yards away from that tree is rotted and ready to fall in your direction, it's coming through your camp with all its branches like spikes to drive in the ground. So it's a larger assessment of your area than just picking a tree and saying, hey, everything looks good.
Yeah. One of the biggest, I guess, fears that's always in the back of my mind when I go out into the woods, and I'm sure a lot of other guys out there listening, is what the hell do you do if you're out there and you get lost? And I know there's a few different, I watched one of the videos too, where it was like a cool technique of, I mean, you can explain this a lot better, but it's like going out in different directions and sort of marking your territory. Yep. And I actually commented on that video and I said, would it be a good idea to maybe like put numbers into the areas that you're going, so you don't like come across them again? Do you know what I mean? So instead of like marking it with like an X on the tree, and it might be too time consuming, but I was thinking that if you mark these different paths with like a number, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you have like 20 different paths, you know that you're not going to keep going back over the same paths if it's just an X, because there's, you know, no way to differentiate it. But I like that idea. And I never heard that, of like going out a certain amount and then coming back to your little camp that you set up and you keep going out in different directions. But what other things can you do? If you're out in the wilderness, like say you're going out hunting with some friends and you go out like a mile or so, and then all of a sudden you look around, it's getting dark and you don't know where the hell you are.
Yep.
You know, how do you use things like a compass? Say you get maybe stuck overnight and you wake up in the morning and, you know, you can use the compass in the morning. What do you do to get yourself out of there?
Yeah. So what you were referring to first was, we call it the Ray method, where you realize you're lost. You're going to make a mark, some type of marker. It might be a burnout campfire or something that you can identify quickly. And then you're going to move, in one direction for a little bit, marking trees, which we call blazes. And then we move back, follow those blazes back to our original campsite that we knew we were lost from. Ideally with that, the numbering system would work fine. But what you're really trying to do when you do that is you're trying, without knowing, you're going in four directions to start. So it's pretty instinctive to be able to say, hey, if I'm walking straight forward this time and I come back to camp and I'm standing at the campfire, if I turn around and I walk the other way, I can do that and I'm not going to cross over that path again. And when you do four routes, you really went north, south, east, and west, probably. And if you, or some deviation of those, and then you can start to break that down. You should start to quickly see some land features and stuff that seem somewhat relevant to you. So, you know, to sort of focus in that area, with that. So that technique works really good. Again, ton, like you said, the numbering thing I never thought of, but that is probably a really good idea if you have a lot of routes or when you start to get somewhere that you're like, hey, I know that mountain peak out in the distance is something that we were parked by. Now I can use that system to narrow it down a little bit more. As far as a compass, people overcomplicate the use of a compass dramatically. Because they want to really, again, it's one of those things, they want to get super technical with it and they want to be drawing lines on their maps and doing triangulation and everything else. I tell people this all the time. As long as you understand that when you stand somewhere and you spin around, it's 360 degrees. If you know that, you're good. Like, it's very simple to use the compass. So this is what I tell people all the time. There you go. So you have a compass in there. So if you're standing,
I don't know how the hell to use it though, I'll be honest.
I'm going to tell you right now, this is literally the easiest thing to do. Cause I make my kid do it all the time. He's seven. So he can do it. Now he thinks he's a math wizard and he's going to send rockets to space by next year, but, you'll be good. So we know 360 degrees. It's literally that easy. We get the compass out, the needle, the red always points to north. So when you stand there, you point your needle to north and then, so whatever direction you're standing, that needle's going to north. And then you're going to look at the compass and whatever, where you're facing, okay, you're going to see at the top of the compass, the number, that's the degree reading that you're facing at, okay? So it, let's just say at the top of the compass, the way you're standing, okay, needle goes to north, and then you look and you're facing 270 degrees, okay? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you have your compass out there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you not need to put it on a flat surface either?
You're just going to hold it flat. You're just going to hold it nice and level. Yep. So hold it nice and level. And then put the, so there should be like a mark on the top, like arrows pointing forward.
Yep.
Right. So they're going to go, they're going to point forward the same way you're looking. So they point like in our case.
Okay. Right? Yep.
So that's all you're looking at. Right.
Yep.
Okay. So now you see the needle is probably not pointing directly at me either. So you're not pointing north, I'm assuming.
No.
Okay. So you would rotate that compass on that flat plane until that red needle goes in there. Looks like a little red shed on the plate of the compass.
Yep.
So as you rotate it, you'll see that little red shed underneath the needle. The red needle and the red shed go together. We call that putting the needle in the doghouse.
Okay.
See where you're at there?
So you, you line up the red. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Okay. Yep.
Like a little red house. It looks like a little red house on the glass underneath the needle.
Yep. Got it.
All right. So you rotate that the whole compass until the needle is in that little house.
Yep.
Now the compass is going to look like it's skewed to one side or the other. Okay. So what now you're going to keep that needle in the doghouse, whatever number is straight in front of you, the direction you were looking, what number is that?
300.
Okay. 300. So you know now when you start to walk, you're generally walking 300 degrees into the woods, right?
Yeah.
So you might vary that. You're not going to walk a perfectly straight line, but you know your bearing is 300 degrees, okay?
Yeah.
So you get in the woods, you're doing your stuff, okay? You realize you're lost. So how you know you walked in 300 degrees. So you know a circle is 360 degrees. So the difference is what? 180.
Yeah.
Right. So we got to go backwards. So if we take 180 away from that 300, where are we at? 120.
120. Yeah.
So as long as we now do the same thing and find 120 degree bearing out, we have our way out.
So by 120 degree bearing out, what does that mean? You go that, like that angle out?
Yep.
So whatever that angle creates. Yeah, you. So
if you were lost now, what you would do is pull your compass out. You'd put the needle back in the dog. So the needle, you face the compass north, turn it needle in the doghouse.
Yep.
Okay. And then what you're going to do is you're going to rotate that until you get to 120 and then you understand your way back out. So that's your general direction back out because you walked in at 300. So we walk out at 120.
Okay. Gotcha.
So you get that?
Yep. Yep. That actually makes sense. Okay. That's all you have to do. That's as simple as it gets.
That is as simple as it gets.
Wow. So you don't need a map. You don't need to have like a perfectly level surface. You don't need any crazy math.
No. All you need to know is how to subtract 180 degrees.
Okay. That's actually
pretty simple. Know the difference of 180 degrees. So if you're at 2 degrees, right? We have, you know, it's 182 degrees out.
Yeah.
You're facing directly north, you know, it's 180 degrees out south.
Okay. I feel like people have made it way more complicated in different videos that I've seen over the years.
Yes, it is not. People do make it overly complicated and it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to.
So that's a good one too. Obviously having a compass is pretty important when you're out in the woods.
Yes. Yeah. And as long as you know that general direction in, as long as you know how to find north and you know that bearing, even if you just look, hey, north is this way. Let's just say north is where I am. You know, you're looking at me, I'm north. Okay. So you know that as you turn to your right, okay, that's, so north is zero. You know, it's 1 degree, 2, 3, 4, 90 is east, 180 is south, 270 is west. So if you're standing there, you know, north, because you look at your compass, you're like, oh, my needle points this way, it points towards Dan, and you point at zero, and then you turn to 90 degrees because that's where you're walking. Okay. So you just turn that way and you think in your head, okay, I turned about 90 degrees. Okay. So you walk that way into the woods. Now you don't even need a compass. All you had to do is use that compass to find north. So you walk into the woods at 90 degrees, you realize you're lost. What degrees you have to walk to come out? 270. Yep. Because it's 180 degrees different than 90. That's all you got to do.
So that's pretty simple.
Simple stuff like that. You don't need a map. You don't have to get crazy with the compass. Literally that easy.
Yeah. What happens though, if you stray a little bit off course, like say you're not, you know, lined up, you're a few degrees off with how you're walking. Does so that throw you off a bit?
It is going to throw you off a bit, but again, you got to think in the terms of, hey, I'm lost. Can I get back to the general area? Now, of course, if you're traveling on a big hiking trail and you're 70 miles away from your vehicle and you were up and down mountains and going east, and then next thing you know, a mile later, going west, I mean, that changes that dynamic. But most people in a hunting type situation, they're 1, 2, 3, 5 miles in. They know the general area they're headed when they're going to go hunt. They'll know that general area out. Normally there's roads or something they can hit. And if you were lost, you're not going to be afraid to hit a road and say to somebody, hey, can I use your phone? Or hey, what way do I get to this parking area for hunting or anything like that?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Anything else regarding direction that we should know, the guys listening should know about?
No, I think the big one is if you just learn how to find north on your compass, which the needle is going to go to north. If you can learn that bearing that I just talked about, how to find your bearing and the direction you're facing, you can do from there. Literally everything with the compass is based off of that. So that's the big one. And the big one is to have a compass with you. A lot of people don't want to have it because they're like, I don't know how to use it. But again, just finding north, that's huge, because you can then say, that's north. I'm facing, you know, 170 degrees. So to get out of there, I need to figure out the 180 degree difference of that.
Gotcha.
Yep.
What about starting a fire? If you need to start a fire, which, you know, happens if you get lost, you have to spend a few days in the woods. In general, you know, if you go out in the woods, you want to cook or something, you know, you need a fire, you keep warm, you need a fire. Why do you recommend the what is it called, the flint?
So I always tell people for survival, you're looking at a ferrocerium rod, which we call a ferro rod. Flint and steel is a very traditional method, super fun to do. It's a hard piece of metal with a rock and some what we call char cloth or charred material. You make a little ember, and then I'm sure everybody on TV saw people blowing birds' nests to flame. That's what that process is. Definitely not the type of thing you want to be doing in an emergency. So ferro rod, or what's even better, I tell people, is take a lighter. I mean, it's like, oh, I'm cheating because I have a lighter, but you just need a fire and you're in an emergency, right? So take your lighter. A ferro rod does require a little bit of skill, and a ferro rod is the black rod that throws some spark when you strike it. So one of those is great to have along with you because they don't freeze. You can use them forever. You're not going to run out of sparks, but you still have to know how to use that a little bit. Lighter, you can light almost anything. Just keep the lighter going. And if you're really panicking that you're going to be in a really bad situation, I tell people carry a small road flare, light that, and then just build your fire off of that.
No kidding. What about matches? I have a ton of matches in here. Is that a good idea or no?
Yeah, matches are good. Again, there's a little bit of skill, and it sounds crazy to tell people there's a skill to using a match. What always happens with any type of fire is we have this flame source. So think of a lighter, think of a match, or a spark, any of those things. We need to take that and grow that into something more. Most people, if you go to a common campground and it's a little bit rainy, they don't have a problem making that flame. They can light their match. They can light their lighter. They can throw a spark. They can't get that to grow. So that is where the difficulty comes in. So if you have matches, a lighter, a ferro rod, you always want to try to carry some type of fire device with you along. So like there, if you go to REI or Cabela's, you know, they have something called wet fire. We sell different fire starters on our sites. There's a ton of different stuff. Cotton ball and Vaseline works great. That will extend and grow that flame for a lot longer than a match will burn. So that's burning. Then it allows, if you put small wood on top of that, for the wood to dry out, the wood to start to catch, and then that wood will start to grow into a bigger flame. And then we can add more wood and more wood and more wood, and then grow that into a campfire. So that's the hardest part of starting a fire in an emergency, is taking that small, we always say, one flame source and turning it into this monster flame source.
Yeah. What do you do if you have wet wood or damp wood, or if it's raining, how would you get around that to actually get it to light? Cause you said that, I mean, it's true. The easiest part is lighting the match, or, you know, the turning the lighter on, but like, yep. How do you get it to grow if it's actually wet? Cause one of the hardest things I've noticed to do over the years is, you know, start a fire when you have wet wood.
Yes. So the most common technique to use for that is to get smaller branches and actually split them, because the wood inside the branch is going to be dry. It's only the outside that's wet. Okay. So when you're trying to start the fire, you're normally trying to dry out that outside, and you just don't have enough flame source to dry it out. So by splitting that open, we're exposing the dry wood on the inside. So once that's exposed inside our shelter, now we can take our knife or our saw, whatever we have, and then we can start to cut smaller pieces off of that shavings, which generally is what we want to do. So we take a 1 or 2 inch piece of wood, maybe about a foot long. We split it in half. We split them halves again. Now we have 4 pieces of wood. They're all dry except that little outside edge. Take our knife, and then we really finely run it down the edge. We create shavings, which the shavings are nice and dry, small, so they take a flame really nice and easily. So that grows that flame source to a little bit bigger flame. And then we can start to add some of that wet wood in. Always small stuff. People put too big a wood on it first. The smaller, the better. When you collect small stuff to make that small flame grow into something larger, at least the size of a basketball, if not 2 or 3 basketballs worth, is going to be more than enough small stuff to actually get going. And the smaller, the better. I tell people pine trees all the time. You know, the small branches underneath the pine tree are normally, even if they're wet, they dry out nice and quick. Along with them shavings works really, really well.
Nice. What do you do then to avoid it? If it's a heavy rainfall and you had to start a fire, what would you do to stop it from actually getting soaked on?
Yeah. So, you can, it depends. If I always tell people you need to carry some type of tarp or shelter with you. Carrying a tent, isn't the best for survival, because you can't utilize your fire to its full potential to keep you warm and stuff. So you really want some type of open shelter, which is just using a tarp. And then you can set that up in a lean-to fashion, which, if you just think of the tarp tied off to 2 trees or between 2 trees, and then the back end of the tarp goes down to the ground, that's a lean-to. Your fire can be out in the front. So if it's torrential downpour, it is extremely difficult to get that fire, honestly, like up and running and going. So you probably missed a couple cues at that point, is what I tell people. Like, you should have had that fire going, that you knew you were lost. You knew it was raining this bad. Or if you were out and it was one of those situations where you're in this environment that rains constantly, you should have had more gear with you to not have to have a fire. So if you do find yourself that you're wet, and it's pouring down rain, and you're becoming hypothermic, and you need to start that fire, you just need to get your tarp up off the ground higher than you normally would, as like a roof, and start creating your fire underneath it. And then as it grows, don't burn your tarp up, of course, but as it grows up and you get it more sustainable, that it's strong enough to withstand rain, and you want to get it bigger, move your tarp back off over the top. And then just build it up from there. So that's a tough process, though, for just about anybody to go through.
Yeah. Have you had to do that before, maybe on that show or anything?
I didn't have to do it on the show. I let my fire go out, and I made sure on dry days I always had enough wood stockpiled and enough small stuff stockpiled, so I never had to worry about dry wood. I always had dry wood. But for training purposes, yeah. I had to do that already at courses and stuff. And we make people, the final day of our survival courses, start fires no matter what the weather conditions. So they know enough by the end of that course, if they've have to have their shelter up over that fire to get it going and get it started to boil water, then that's what they have to do. So yeah, definitely doable. You just have to be able to think through it.
Yeah, for sure. And so what are some of the essentials that you're bringing? I'm sure every situation is different. You know, if you're, I don't even know if actually if you cover this or not, but if you were saying like the desert versus obviously in the woods, totally different climates, or if you're, you know, say down south versus up north, totally different climates. Like, do you actually have applicable advice for all sorts of different climates, or are you mostly focusing on the woods area?
No. So although we train in the woods, my advice is this, it literally hits everything, because it comes down to, when we think about emergencies and just keeping ourselves safe, it comes down to the survival priorities. And I stress these beyond stress with people all the time, because if you think about these, it covers everything, no matter what environment you're in. And if you really think about it, you only need four things in life. You need fire, water, shelter, and food. You have those things, you live. You don't live comfortably, but you'll live. So if you have water and a way to boil water or purify water, you can hydrate yourself. If you have a shelter, which is your clothing and a way to protect yourself from the rain, wind, you got that covered. You're going to control your body's core temperature, right? If you have fire, you can now cook food, you can warm yourself, you can boil your water. So you can do all that stuff with fire. And then if you have food, now you're nourishing yourself. Outside of that, there's nothing else you need. So as long as you have a way to boil water, which I always tell people, you need to take some type of metal container along with you. Okay. So that would be, a lot of people take like a Nalgene plastic bottle with them. So I always say, lose that, put one bottle that's metal. Now you don't want to take something that's double walled. It's like insulated, because you can't boil water in that. So you want to take a single wall bottle. You can put in a fire, titanium, aluminum, anything like that. You can fill up any kind of water. If you boil water, it 100% will disinfect it. So you're good to go. So you can boil your water with your container. You have it, you're good to go. Fire, like I said, definitely you need that, but you want to make sure you have a way to consistently start fire. So for you, if it's matches, cotton balls and Vaseline to extend those matches, by all means, there you go. You got your fire covered. You want to dress appropriately for the seasons, have some type of tarp shelter with you if you know you're going to be out in the woods or out in the desert, wherever, to protect you from the elements, the wind or anything like that. Or you have your fire out in front, it traps the heat, and then food. So outside of that, there's nothing. So it doesn't matter what environment you're in. The human needs those things in order to survive. So if you get them things covered, you're good to go. And it's really not a lot. People want to build out this monster kit because we love gear so much, right? So, but if you have a water bottle, I tell people water bottle, a shelter, and a fire starter and a couple of granola bars or something, you're good for a long amount of time before something really bad happens.
Really? So even just a couple of granola bars, you survive off of food wise anyways?
Yeah. I mean, I went 51 days on 9 fish. So I think most people will be good for 4 or 5 days with a couple granola bars.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people are into keto now too. And you know, that whole theory is burning fat anyways. And I think there's a lot of truth to it too, about your body going on like overdrive, where it actually can last weeks with just burning the fat and using that as fuel. It's not fun. It's not comfortable. But actually, that's kind of what fat is, at least the theory of why we actually store body fat is to be able to use it in an emergency.
Right. No, and I agree with that too. I could tell you from personal experience, again, being involved in fitness, there's times I get pretty lean and there's times I'm a little bit thicker. When I'm thicker and I'm out in the woods, it is way more comfortable and I do much better than when I'm leaned out, you know? And it's nice when you're like out in the summer and you're going for a jog and you're all leaned out and you got abs and stuff. But when you're out in the winter and you're lean like that, it's brutal. And you could tell your energy gets zapped quicker and stuff. So I can say from being in the field, 100%, I totally agree with that. That's them fat stores definitely play a huge role in true outdoor, you know, mankind living.
Oh yeah. 100%. I actually have a buddy of mine who's, and he'll willingly admit this, but he's quite obese. He's well over 300 pounds. And he's like my height, like 5'7", 5'8" ish. Huh. And, you know, we'll be drinking a couple beers or something in the wintertime. It's like 30 degrees out, and he'd take his shirt off and just like, you know, he's totally fine. I'm like, dude, I have like two jackets on. It's freezing out here. Yep. So, you know, the body fat actually does protect you. It has some benefits if you look at it that way. And if you're going out in the cold like that, it certainly can keep you warm and keep you more nourished, at least for, you know, a time being, compared to someone else who's more lean like me. But going back to some of the essentials here, what else are we talking about as far as like what you would bring specifically? We have those four major needs that we have to cover. Yep. How much like is your back, how much is your backpack weighing, and how much actual like things or how many objects are you putting into that backpack? You don't want to get too weighed down, I'm supposing, but you do also want to have enough.
No. So honestly, one water bottle, for me, one water bottle of ferrocerium rod. We make a small emergency shelter that weighs under 6 ounces. And one or two protein bars is all I add extra to my kit when I go out.
That's it. Like, huh?
That is it. So if I need to live for a week out there, it's going to suck, but I'll live. Mm-hmm. I don't need anything. Now, if I want to be more comfortable, then I would add more things. So, one of the first things I always add on top of that, if I can add more food, is food. Cause that is tough to get out there. Some type of moisture barrier, because when it's wet, it's rainy, it's cold. Getting something between you and the wet ground to lay on and sleep on every night without having to build something like a debris bed is glorious. So having just a sheet of plastic, a 55-gallon drum liner, something that's small and lightweight that seems like it's not even there, that type of thing, that is absolutely wonderful to have along with you, to be able to put underneath you. I also carry a military poncho liner often in my like survival type kit, because those, they're nice and warm, they're cheap, they're pretty packable. So in a backpack, if you put that in there, you have a blanket you can sit on. So if you're hunting, you just throw it down, you can sit on that. If it's wet out, you put down the 55-gallon drum liner and then the blanket, keep your butt warm. And if you have to sleep out there, now you have a blanket along with you. So they're like the main things. And then again, outside of that, you continue to think, well, what other kind of skill sets do you have for things? So I carry a lot of rope and cordage and stuff like that, because I can utilize that in a lot of different things when I'm building. If I was building traps, or I was building frog gigs, or trying to secure food, I can use all that stuff. So it really just depends at that point then what your actual goal is and what your skill set is. One thing I think most people find interesting, which you'll notice I didn't even mention yet, other than making shavings, is a knife. Yeah. Like a knife is one of those things that everybody, when you talk survival, the first thing they're worried about is their knife. And it's probably, in a true situation, for an untrained person, it's the last thing that they're going to be using. If you have a shelter that you can tie up between two trees, a way to start your fire, a way to boil water and something to eat, that knife is out of the equation. So although it's super like alpha male monster knife on your hip kind of thing, it's just not in the mix of stuff. And I would say in our classes, outside of making people like process natural materials for fires, if we didn't do that, they don't even need a knife for our basic level, like survival class. They don't even pull it out. So that is one of the misconceptions. I love Rambo, but I blame Rambo.
I was just going to say, yeah.
I'm like, that is what did our culture in with a knife will get you through. And the thing with a knife, it can get you through. If you have the skill set to take that knife and know how to cut trees and cut saplings and cut branches to make a shelter and make cordage with that, by all means, take your knife. If you know how to take that knife and carve a bow drill friction fire set to make friction fire, knife comes in handy. If you can cut logs and carve out a vessel to rock boil water to purify it, yes. So that's where the knife comes in. When you don't have those things that we're talking about carrying, that's really when that comes in real handy. Otherwise, most people can carry a pocket knife and get through with it.
Okay, cool. What about, you mentioned starting, I think you mentioned starting a fire with rubbing sticks.
Yes.
Is that feasible? Is that one of the hardest things to do? I actually seen on a couple of those survival shows, these survival experts really struggling to get that going. And these guys are, you know, the best of the best.
Yes. So once you learn the base, so if I would just say to anybody, hey, here's some wood, do this. They're going to have a hard time doing it. There's technique to it. And there are the technical know-how of how to actually what we call carve your set. So if you have those two things down and you understand it, this is when the trouble happens, because it depends on the material you have available at that time. So depending on your environment, if you stick you in a place where it's all hardwood, so it's all oak and hickory and it's wet, good luck doing that.
Yeah.
You just don't have the resources available. If you're in the desert though, and you have yucca and you can just like blast through a hand drill, I mean, that is what that's where that came from, right? So it depends on your environment, you know, and that's why you see people struggle a lot, because they're in these really crazy environments, the jungle, and they're sort of put in that predicament. They have to make this happen. So they do a fire plow, which is pushing a board against a board, or Eastern Woodlands, where I'm at, you know, we're looking at a bow drill friction fire. So you have the bow and you're spinning it. There's certain kinds of wood you want to use for that. Now you can make it work with other wood, extremely more difficult. Your skill level has to be a lot higher. And at the end of the day, even for a super trained expert, it takes a while. You know, you might be looking at, if you have the wood right there, I'm like, hey, we use a lot of tulip poplar and cedar in our area. So if I'm standing there, I'm like, hey, there's a tulip poplar tree with a perfect branch. I'm going to rip that down. I might be able to get that fire, that ember, and the fire started in a 15 to 20 minute period. And that's like busting my butt super hard, going after it. Not even a good set. Just, I know, hey, the environment's right and I can get this done. And I've done that hundreds and hundreds of times. So, and I can do that. But if you throw somebody who did it once with store-bought lumber into this environment, it's wet, it's raining, like, good luck. It's not, to me, it's a good skill to learn more about fire, but it's not a feasible skill that I would say most people, they need to practice. They need to practice more with their ferro rod, and literally like matches.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. Do ferro rods, do they run out of, how many times you can use them? Do they have a limited?
Well, amount? After a while. So as you keep striking them, they look black when you first buy them. And then as you strike them, that black comes off. That's just a coating they put on the outside. So it depends. We all carry, like myself, my instructors, we carry 6-inch by 1/2-inch ferro rods. So they're bigger. You get thousands and thousands and thousands of sparks off of those. The really, really small ones are sort of like more of a novelty type thing, and they'll work. You might not get as much. After time, you get like a divot in them. And then you sort of know it's time to go. But if you took a fresh one out, or one that you were practicing with at home, and you used it up in the field in a survival situation, you probably at that point are like a frontiersman, and you have a cabin and everything built. Cause I've never in my, I mean, I had some of them wore down, but I never wore one out to the point it was gone. So yeah, get a long time out of those.
That's awesome, man. What about, I saw a video where you found some, I forget what you called it, but there was some type of mushroom. It was like a golden or yellow type of mushroom, and you started picking it and foraging it. What about people out in, you know, the wild about, you know, food, if they run out of granola bars and they're stuck more than a couple of days, what can they actually do for food?
Yeah. Food's a super tricky one too. That's where your skill level starts to kick in. I'm the first to admit that I'm not a big plant, wild edible kind of guy. It's not that I don't find it interesting. I just, in my general life, everyday life, I'm not like, hey, I'm going to have a salad kind of guy. I'm like, hey, I'm going to eat steak, or like, like get my pizza kind of, I'm just like that. Right. So what I found with that is, again, that's very seasonal. So if it's winter here and you go out in Pennsylvania, you don't have tons of greens to eat. There's very little, right? I'm not going to find a ton of berries. I'm not going to find mushrooms. Well, you can find some, but to fill you up, if I gave you a bowl of lettuce every day for the next week, you're probably going to say at some point, I'm pretty hungry. Yeah. You're not getting enough calories from it. So, I don't think there's anything wrong with studying that. And I know people who love, one of my instructors is like awesome at all the plants, wild edibles, trees. But you don't get much from it at the end of the day. You know, you can go out and forage and get all this stuff and eat it, and you can get some vitamins and nutrients, which is a mental boost. But as far as legit calories to keep you alive, I just don't see it there. And so I always focus more on what type of meat sources that you can secure. So we always start at the easiest to the hardest. So we say we're going to go into water, to the water's edge, small game, medium game, large game. If you follow that, it's pretty easy. Most kids, little kids, they can throw some type of fishing rig into the water and catch something. So if you are going to be out in an environment, you think that, hey, maybe we're out going to be stuck out here longer, or that there's a higher risk of you maybe getting lost out there, carrying a couple fishing hooks with a sinker and some line. I mean, you don't even know that's in your pocket kind of thing. It's worth doing. Making that off the land is horrible. Making fishing line and hooks and stuff, you need, again, resources. Can you find bone? Can you find thorns? Can you do these things? And you have the skill set to do it. So carrying a little fishing kit, definitely worth it. Around the water's edge, you're looking at stuff like turtles. You're looking at frogs in the summertime is a huge one. A frog gig is super easy to make. You literally take a stick, you split it four ways at the end, and then carve each one of those four points into a little spike. And then you can pin the frogs down. You stab right through them. You can eat frog legs, and you can get a lot of them every day type thing. Snakes, as long as you understand what are poisonous and what are not poisonous, I tell people, if you're in a situation, don't go after poisonous snakes, because you probably don't have the know-how how to handle them. And you don't want to take a chance. You're lost already. Now let's get bit on top of it and have to deal with it. So if you can get a snake or a turtle or something like that, easy stuff, you know, like that stuff kids catch. They catch fish, they catch frogs, they catch lizards, like these types of things. Like, so do that, because that's easy for you to do. Yeah. And then going from there, real, real small stuff, mice, you'll see that on shows a lot. We're catching mice. Well, do you ever skin a mouse out? Because there's not much to it, right? So, I mean, calorie wise, other than you feel good. So if you want to really get your hormones pumping and you want to get them chemicals in your brain saying, hey, we did something, we're accomplishing stuff, which is by all means important. But you're not getting any calorie benefit from that. You'd be better off catching 10 more little fish than trying to trap one little mouse with a deadfall type trap. Really? Yeah. So you want to, for me, at least personally, I tell people, again, that's one of those things. If it's mentally going to boost you up and you think that that's worth it, do it. If that occupies your mind and gets it off the fear of being trapped out there, do it. But if you're looking to live off of mice, or live off, you catch a bird, a little bird, you know, that's not going to do much. Then the medium sized game, of course, you have to have more skill or maybe more equipment. If you're out hunting, your rifle's a great thing, because you can shoot a deer and you can take that deer and you can, you know, dry it out over the fire. If it's cold, you can just hang it in the tree, cook the meat as needed, and be good to go with it.
Yeah. So you would say actually the frog legs have more calories, like pound for pound, frog legs would be better than catching a whole mouse.
Oh yeah, by far. Way more meat on it.
Really? Yeah. No kidding.
Yeah, that's way more meat.
And way easier, I'm sure, to catch than a mouse.
If you shine a headlamp on a frog, you can see its eyes glowing and they sort of just sit there. Now, if you get close and move around, they'll, you know, go under. But the big bullfrogs, I mean, their legs are as big as a hot wing.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah. So I mean, you do get a lot of meat off them.
How do you cook these? Are you just roasting them on the fire for an hour out?
Yeah, that kind of situation. So frogs is just the back leg. The rest of it's pretty much, there's nothing to it. It's a lot of guts and stuff. So with the frog, you grab the skin, you rip it off, which you can just do with your bare hands. The legs, the meat is exposed on the leg, and then we just roast them over the fire. I mean, if you have stuff that you can legitimately like batter them and cook them, I mean, they're awesome. But yeah, you just roast them over the fire and eat it. I tell people all the time, you don't want to overcook. Of course, most people are going to be like squeamish for like, hey, eat it rare. And I'm not saying do that, but when you're cooking wild game like that, you don't want to cook it to the point that you destroy it. So I tell people, cook it till it looks like it's cooked, cut it open with your knife or rip it apart or take a little bite. And if it seems like it's still undercooked a little bit, just cook it on the fire a little bit more, rather than constantly, like we don't have to make this gourmet meal out there all the time. So if you have a chunk of meat and you're cooking it, cut the outside off, eat that, throw the rest back on if it doesn't seem done kind of thing in a survival situation. Or even better, with fish, if you boil things, you'll get all the nutrients because you could drink the water afterwards. So if you get a fish and you just cut it up into sections and boil it, after it's gutted out, you can eat it and then the bones are left inside with a lot of the fat and stuff, which that's from the skin. You can drink the broth, which you're getting all the calories that way then. So that's an even better situation.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good idea. Actually, you're not losing anything there.
Yeah.
What, so actually, I meant to ask you this earlier when you mentioned the boiling part and you have a water bottle of like a metal water bottle. How would you be able to boil? Like, how would you hold that water bottle over the fire to get it to boil? Obviously, if you're holding it with your hand, you're going to burn your hand. You're just sticking it in the fire.
Yeah, you stick it right in the edge of the fire and just let it sit there. The fire will heat it up. You'll see it boiling. And then to get it out, couple tricks. You can either take a small piece of wood, which we consider a toggle, tie a little rope on it, and then you just drop it down inside. The toggle, so you know that the like the neck, so the bottle comes up, there's a little neck that goes into the drinking part. So like the top part of it. So your toggle should be as wide as the neck of the bottle. So when you drop it into the bottle through the top, it'll go down and catch both sides of the neck and you can lift it out. Or you take a branch that's a Y branch and just stick it down inside. It'll tighten up as it goes down in the bottle and then spring open when it's inside and you pull it right out.
Nice. And if you have, say, a frog that you want to cook, you want to boil them, what like do you stick them in the water bottle like that, or would you have to get some other type of contraption to do that whole thing?
So if you were doing that and you honestly needed the calories, you want to be drinking anyway. So you would just take your water bottle, you would throw the legs in, put it in, let it boil a little while, bring it out, let it cool, pull the frog legs out, drink the water, and have at it.
Okay. That's a good one. That's actually really cool. And so what else do you think that, you know, guys listening need to know as far as when it comes to the essentials? Like, you know, you're out there for a few days, you get lost, maybe a couple days, maybe even a full day of like hunting turns into like a week.
Yep.
What do you recommend before we wrap things up in a few minutes that guys need to know or should bring with them? Like, what are the essentials that they have to either know or should take with them on these trips?
Yeah. So I think as long as you cover those survival priorities in your own way, whatever you think would be best, I think that you're setting yourself up for success. To go beyond that, I think what we talked about with the compass, if you understand the general way to use a compass, you're setting yourself up for success with that. And then the last two things that are a little like off from what I think most people would think in a survival instructor would tell them is number one, take an extra battery pack for your phone to charge it up if you have service in that area. So like our area here in Appalachian Mountains, there's very few spots we go that we don't have cell phone reception. So the biggest issue we have is that it runs out of energy or runs out of power. So having a battery backup, and you can buy them things anywhere. You can buy them at a dollar store. They charge up, they charge your phone two or three more times and you're good. That's awesome. And then those units, there's all different brands, but they're like the spot units for places you're not going to have cell phone reception if you're far in the backcountry. You can get those and then you can buy like a 1 month like membership kind of thing for those. And then it gives a satellite signal. You can hit it for SOS. They know exactly where you're at, what's going on. Some of the units you can even text on. So, I mean, it's well worth using that technology. We have it. I think in the survival world, a lot of times people, they want to be primitive because it seems cool, but it's not cool to die. So it's like, okay, I get it. You go into a class, you're not going to bring a spot unit out and do all this stuff, or you're just going out for the day in the local woods hunting, might be extreme. But to throw an extra battery pack in, or say, I know people, they say, I'm going to leave my phone in the car because I'm going in the woods. Well, you're an idiot. I mean, literally, like take this with you. It can help you. You don't have to be on it all day. Like you don't have to be on Instagram all day. Turn your phone off. But if something happens, at least you have a means to connect with people now. So that's something that, you know, I think we hear in the old manuals, like carry a map and compass. Well, they didn't have the technology we have now. So if I had to rewrite that manual, I'd be like, take your cell phone, take your spot unit, because that can help you. So I think it's just those types of things. They're like major things that people need to be aware of.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing I forgot to mention was attacks from wild animals. You know, bears come to mind, fox, wolves, etc. Do you recommend bringing a firearm to protect yourself in the woods like that? Or if you're staying overnight for a few nights, is that important? Have you seen these types of animals around you? Do you think they present enough danger to warrant that?
So I think it depends on the area that you're in. If you're in grizzly bear country, by all means, you need something to protect yourself. If you're in an area of like super densely populated predator, like big cats that are going to, you know, be hunting, yes, you should probably have something along with you. Here in the woods in Pennsylvania, we have no predators that are going to come after us. Like black bears run if you see them. Bobcats don't want anything to do with you. If you hear a coyote or see a coyote, they run. So like those type animals, we don't worry about at all. I don't personally worry about. But again, that just comes down to a comfort type thing. I carried for when I first started going out on my own a lot. It's scary to be out by yourself. I don't care how tough you think you are. When you're out in the woods and you're deeper in and you're by yourself and it's night and you can't see more than 20 yards away from the fire, it's nerve-wracking when you hear wild noises and stuff. So I used to carry a gun with me. Just it made me feel better. And then, I mean, I got away from that over the years. Now I'm just like, all right, I'll just lay here. I don't like, who cares kind of thing. But it's just a comfort level type thing. But by all means, if you're in an area with predators and a big game that's dangerous, I definitely think you should have something. I would, for me, I'm a gun guy. So I'd be like, yeah, carry a gun with you.
Yeah, I agree. I'm the same way, especially, you know, when I'm go hunting, I, you know, have a firearm on me anyway. So it's like, you feel a little bit safer no matter what it is. I've had friends that have seen bears up in Vermont, coyotes and things like that. I don't know about a wolf yet, but you know, some pretty dangerous things that could potentially, you know, take somebody out if, you know, they felt threatened or whatever else. And that movie, The Revenant, comes to mind too, with the grizzly bear, and he, you know, completely mauls him. That's crazy. And he actually shoots the bear and it still goes after him, and it like mauls him after that. And I think it dies like later on from the shot, right?
Yes. Yeah. But, so, I mean, I would think that, and he stabbed it too in the movie. I love that movie.
It's a great movie. I don't know how true it is. I think it's, you know, a lot of it's a little exaggerated, but.
Yeah, but I think that's another thing too. I mean, when people go, and people ask that question, we used to ask in classes a lot. They ask about, you know, should they carry a firearm? What should they do? And I'll say, if you know how to use the firearm, of course, you know where to shoot the animal. I mean, if a bear is running at you and you're just going to randomly shoot the bear, you're not just going to put a bear down because you put a bullet into its front shoulder. I mean, it doesn't just get hit. It's a wild animal. The thing doesn't care. It got shot. It's coming at you. So like, you need to know how to shoot. You need to be efficient with that. So that's something I think people need to also take into consideration if they're going to go out. I mean, practice a little bit before you go out, that you're efficient. I mean, imagine a grizzly getting close to your camp and charging at you. You better be able to shoot it at the right spot and not just think, oh, how, you know, take the wrapper off the gun kind of thing.
Yeah. Piss it off even more. You're really screwed. Before we wrap things up, what would you suggest for guys who want to get better at this type of thing? Do you maybe recommend them spending a night in the woods after watching some of your videos, maybe taking one of your classes? Like, what's a good way to start getting better? Because you never know what's going to happen, especially in today's crazy world with everything that's going on. You might actually need to know some of these skills at some point in your life. And it's always good to have them in, you know, your repertoire for later use if you ever have to. What's a good way to actually practice so to like slowly get better at this, kind of like you did, but maybe even faster, and you don't have to spend, you know, years learning all the incredible things you learn, because they can learn from your videos and, you know, how you teach them.
Yeah, I think that the first step they need to do is, I mean, YouTube's a great resource, and it doesn't have to be me. It could be anybody. But I always tell people, cross-reference. If I'm talking about a ferro rod or you find somebody else talking about it, watch one or two more videos, because anybody could put that video out. So it doesn't mean you're an expert in the field. And try to find somebody who is really talking about it in detail so you understand everything about it. Start there. And then put your kit together, in a sense. Like, think about those survival priorities. And then once you get your gear together, just go out for the day, play with it, try to get a fire going. I wouldn't jump in, hey, I got to spend overnight. Just work on getting your shelter up, work on getting your fire started, work on boiling water. You could do those things. We're in a good spot already. And then not just because I own a school, I think that you definitely should take some type of course, because you're getting ahead of the curve rather than learning bad things. It's like anything else. If you learn these bad habits out of the gate, sometimes it's harder for us to work with you to fix them than if you're like, I don't know how to use this device, and we show you this is how you use it. man, you just passed everybody who never, that they're just in their backyard messing and they have no clue. So you leave there with a lot more knowledge. And again, you know, you can go to my school, you can go to other people's schools. We all have different takes on it, but at the end of the day, as long as it's a reputable place, they're going to give you information that's going to work. Right. So I would definitely say after you get your kit together, spend a couple of days, just day trips out playing with your stuff, maybe an overnight, take a class. It'll get you dialed in. And then you really, it opens up your world because now you have all the correct tools and you understand what direction to head with everything. And then from there, you know, whatever you're most interested in, if it is more prepping, bugging out, if it's more the hardcore survival, if it's more, hey, I'm like in your case, hey, I'm hunting. And I just want, and what if I get lost for 2 days? What do I do? Then you can find classes outside of that basic level stuff that's more specific to that. So that would really be what I would say for most people, how to dive into that and get the job done.
Nice. I forgot to ask you this too. What exactly is Colt Cracker Bushcraft? What does that mean? Where did that name come from?
Okay. So Colt Cracker, I live in the anthracite coal region of Pennsylvania. So it's a very small region in eastern Pennsylvania where there is a certain type of coal. It's called hard coal. It's anthracite coal. Everywhere else you hear about coal, like West Virginia and stuff, is bituminous, which is soft coal. So our coal looks like these black diamonds. So there was a huge coal boom in the mid 1800s to the early 1900s. They still mine coal here. They top mine, so they dig down. But when they would mine the coal and they would dig it out of the ground, big chunks would come out of the ground and they would go to what they call a coal breaker. And they would break the coal into different sizes, depending on if it was home heating, industry, stuff like that. So what they called the people in our area were guys who cracked coal in these breakers. They called them coal crackers. So coal crackers, like a regional thing. Okay. And then the bushcraft is a whole nother realm, which we didn't even really get into because we're talking about survival of outdoor experience and living. So bushcraft in a nutshell is basically how to take, it's a lot of traditional skills revisited. So rather than this emergency fire starter, it's a flint and steel fire starter. So how do you take a rock and a flint and make fire? A lot more like leather and canvas and traditional looking, even wardrobe. I don't want to say we dress up, but it's really about living off the land with the gear that you have. So you still take gear in the field, but we take saws, we take axes, we take knives, we make benches, we make cook systems, we sew our own gear, we do that type of thing. We know how to fix stuff. So it's more that. So we run a lot of classes in that. That's really the long-term traditional living is like where my true passion lies with the outdoors. So that's why it's Coal Cracker Bushcraft.
Awesome, man. I had no idea what that meant. And I like it even more. It almost sounds similar to when I asked you earlier, I think before we even started recording, where you were from, but it sounds kind of similar to how the Amish live, which there are a lot of Amish out in Pennsylvania. Would you say it's kind of similar to that?
Yes and no. I would say they're one step further because they're like living off the land in a sense, you know, they're homesteading in a sense. Compared to the bushcrafters, they take all their stuff in. They're there to just make do for the time being, be comfortable, yeah, and then come back out kind of thing.
Yeah. Either way, it's impressive having a lot of those skills and being able to build things with your hands and, you know, how to use the land to, like they used it in primitive days, hundreds, thousands of years ago. And like, would you even use cell phones and newer technology in bushcraft or no?
Oh yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we still have all that stuff at our hands. It's really more that relaxed camp vibe without all the modern kind of equipment. So think of like, hey, you're going out this weekend with all your friends. Nobody's bringing REI stuff, right? They're setting up like canvas tarps. We're using candle lanterns. Mm-hmm. Instead of bringing like a packable grill in, we make a grill out there. We make a tripod. We boil our water off. So nice. Bushcraft are usually the best cooks too. I mean, they make some extravagant meals out there when they're out there. So
nice. Yeah. That's so awesome, man. That's so cool. Hey, it's been a great interview. What is the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, Dan? And then also a place our listeners can check out your work.
Yeah. So I think at the end of the day, just being prepared a little bit to go into the outdoors and just thinking ahead a little bit. is the most important thing. Don't make it a chore. Just make it part of what you do. So carry those few items to hit those survival priorities and just enjoy yourself in the outdoors. If you're enjoying yourself and you have those couple things to keep yourself safe, you're perfect.
Awesome. Love it, man. Dan, it's been really great, man. I really do appreciate your time. And I know our guys are going to love this one. So take care and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, man. Thanks.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.